The urge to watch birds is all but instinctive, dating no doubt from a time when knowing the natural world, what could be eaten and what could eat us, what would heal us and what would bring death, was essential. It's fed by our urge to know as strong as our urge to eat. Could you imagine a lion stalking prey not out of hunger, but out of curiosity?
Welcome to Book Tour. I'm Netta Ulaby. This week, we go to the birds with author Jonathan Rosen. He reads from his new book. It's called The Life of the Skies, Birding at the End of Nature, and it's both a meditation upon and a history of birdwatching. Rosen has written books and novels about the internet and faith and about Jewish life and family. He says writing fiction and nonfiction means thinking about the differences between explanation and mystery. That, unsurprisingly, puts him in mind of watching birds. He says they don't talk, they seem to be doing what they were created to do. Rosen says when he writes, he tries to remember the power of such muteness, even though he uses words all the time. This reading of The Life of the Skies was recorded in March 2008 at the Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C.
Thank you so much for that wonderful introduction. It's wonderful to be here. I really love this bookstore. I was browsing in the back. I forgot to come up and do my thing. I'm going to read and talk about a couple of places in the book. As you heard, it really has several elements that I hope are gradually woven together in the course of the book. And so I'll just give a little sample of each of them or a few of them. And then I hope if you'll have questions, we can talk a little afterwards. I want to begin by reading the epigraph to the book. I love epigraphs. All my books have epigraphs. This book, every chapter has an epigraph. Somehow it's just part of the conversation you have with other writers and other books when you're writing. And the epigraph to this book is from D.H. Lawrence. It comes from this wonderful collection he has called Birds, Beasts, and Flowers, a collection of poems. And at the beginning of the birds section, there's a prose poem which starts, "Birds are the life of the skies, and when they fly, they reveal the thoughts of the skies." The moment I read that, I was really transported. I loved it, and I knew that I was going to call whatever book about bird watching I wrote The Life of the Skies. I just liked saying The Life of the Skies to myself. It made me happy somehow, the way bird watching made me happy. But I realized also that I was remembering that line incorrectly. I somehow thought it was birds are the life of the skies, and when they sing, they reveal the thoughts of the skies. What Lawrence wrote, when they fly, is much better. Because although I love bird song, it's obviously so beautiful and also full of strange biological meaning, birds don't articulate any meaning with their voices or their songs. It's just the sheer fact that they're there. It's their mysterious presence that is so stirring. And that, I think, is what Lawrence was getting at when he says, when they fly, they reveal the thoughts of the skies. At the very end of his life, Yeats wrote in his diary, "Man can never know the truth, but he can embody the truth." And there's something mysterious about that that I feel very much has to do with bird watching. And when you see birds, when I started watching them too, it was the sheer fact that they were there, their migratory journey, their evolutionary journey, that they were somehow intersecting with me, made me think not only and how strange it was that they were there, but how strange it was that I was there. And for me, bird watching very much has to do with what happens not just at the far end of the binoculars looking at that wild animal, but the curious animal at the other end of the binoculars looking out. Another reason I was so drawn to that phrase, the life of the skies, is because it has a kind of theological overtone. And you heard I write about Alfred Russel Wallace. I'm very interested in Darwin. I think we're still only beginning to reckon with what it means to live, essentially 150 years after the Darwinian revolution. What does it mean to say that birds are the life of the skies, or to speak of the life of the skies after Darwin? Is it because the skies have no life of their own, you know, nothing transcendent, no powers, thrones, glories? Or is it possible that biological life itself contains something that is transcendent? I'm very interested in what we look for when we look at nature. What are we really looking for? And I think many people are often looking for something, both within nature and perhaps even behind nature. The book's divided actually into two halves. First half is backyard birds. The second half is birds of paradise. And I'm interested again in how those two elements come together. Bird watching for me is all about mediating between disparate things. So that's the epigraph. I said I'd talk as well as read. I won't be so Talmudic with every sentence. I'm going to read a little bit now. I'm going to read just a little now from the prologue. Everyone is a bird watcher. But there are two kinds of bird watchers, those who know what they are and those who haven't yet realized it. In the United States, a lot of people have realized it, 47.8 million Americans, according to the Fish and Wildlife Service. And yet my passion is constantly greeted with surprise. You? Perhaps it is because I live in a city and lead an urban life. But why should people wonder that I watch birds? It's like being surprised that someone has sex or goes to the bathroom. The surprise reveals ignorance not so much about birds, their beauty, their abundance, their wild allure, as about human nature. We need, as the great biologist Edward O. Wilson has argued, to affiliate with nature in order to be happy. He calls this phenomenon biophilia. The urge to watch birds is all but instinctive, dating no doubt from a time when knowing the natural world, what could be eaten and what could eat us, what would heal us and what would bring death, was essential. It's fed by our urge to know as strong as our urge to eat. Could you imagine a lion stalking prey not out of hunger, but out of curiosity? We name things, we classify them. In the Bible, Adam gives names to the natural world, imposing a human order on a chaos of life, a kind of second creation. Birdwatching is as human an activity as there can be. We have one foot in the animal kingdom, where biologically we belong, but one foot in a kingdom of our own devising. As Walt Whitman said of himself, we are both in and out of the game, and watching and wondering at it. As it turns out, living in a city and watching birds is hardly a contradiction. Modern birdwatching is an urban invention. Institutions of higher learning, where bird skins were available, not to mention collection curators who brought their indoor learning outdoors, were virtual prerequisites as birdwatching came of age. When a man is tired of London, he's tired of life, said Dr. Johnson. I live in New York City, a metropolis greater than Johnson's London, and I feel the same way about my city, but I feel that way partly because it was in New York City that I discovered birds. More and more I realize that to be bored with birds is to be bored with life. I say birds rather than some generic nature because birds are what remain to us. Yes, deer and coyote show up in the suburbs. You can see grizzlies in Yellowstone Park, and certainly there are bugs galore. But in Central Park, two blocks from my apartment, hundreds of species of birds pass through by the thousands every spring and fall, following ancient migratory routes as old as the Ice Age. If herds of buffalo or caribou moved seasonally through the park, I'd no doubt go out to see them. But the only remaining wild animals in abundance that carry on in spite of human development are birds. The rainforest is far away, but these birds, who often winter there, bring it with them. Here is the nature my biophiliac soul needs to affiliate with. In our mother's womb, we float in water, a remnant of our aquatic origins that we somehow took with us when we left the oceans that spawned us eons ago. But where are the woods, the fertile forests that also constituted the womb of our species? Birds bring us fragments, not in their beaks, but on their backs. Tiny fragments, to be sure, and not enough, but something. So that's a piece of the prologue. And one of the things I really love about birdwatching is the fact that you can really do it almost anywhere. You know, if you have a backyard, you can go into your backyard. If you live in a city, you can go into a park. For me, I go into Central Park and pretend it's my backyard. And without going very far, you see birds that have, in fact, gone very far. The birds that I see now will be seeing soon in spring, perhaps spent the winter in Costa Rica or the Dominican Republic and Central America and South America, and they may be on their way to the northern part of the state or the northern part of the country or Canada or beyond. So without actually having gone more than a block or two, suddenly your mind begins to expand outward into this ever-enlarging geographical web until pretty soon it's embraced the whole world, which is very moving. And if you think of the evolutionary journey the bird has made, it's even more thrilling, really, where they came from, their dim reptilian past to the present moment. But despite that fact that you don't have to actually go anywhere, it's like being a writer. You don't have to go anywhere, but it is good to go somewhere. And another aspect of birding that is quite wonderful is the quest, the search for a particular bird, the search for birds in general. And there is a particular quest for a particular bird threaded through this book as well, which is a search for the ivory-billed woodpecker, a bird I imagine most people here, if not everyone, has heard of. It was the largest woodpecker in America, 21 inches long. It's been officially considered extinct since the 1940s, but in this Elvis-like way, people keep seeing it. And I guess in 2004, there was what was considered an official sighting. It was a giant front-page newspaper story in the New York Times, I'm sure here as well, everywhere. And then it was kind of unseen afterwards in this mysterious way, so that it continues to live in this sort of in-between state. And In 2000, I went down to write a story for The New Yorker about the ivory-billed woodpecker. There was a guy in Louisiana, a forestry student, who was out turkey hunting, and he saw these two large, beautiful birds, and he knew his birds. He knew it wasn't a pileated woodpecker, which is the only other kind of bird it might have been. And so he described it in great detail to a local ornithologist at Louisiana State University who was sufficiently persuaded to set in motion a series of searches that really have culminated in the grand search that maybe saw the bird in 2004. Anyway, I'm going to read just a tiny bit about this from a chapter called The Ghost Bird about the ivory bill, but the ivory bill pops up throughout the book. And I guess I'll just say one more thing, and then I really read less. The more I talk, the less I'll read, I promise. One of the common names of the bird, or the name for the bird that has become common now and was used in all the newspaper stories, is the Lord God bird, in addition to being called the Grail bird. And it's said that that was a common name for the bird, that when people saw the bird, it was so huge, they would say, Lord God, what a bird. But actually, James T. Tanner, who really wrote the book on the ivory bill in the 1940s, who studied the bird, in its last redoubt in Louisiana, has this list in his book of more than 20 common names for the ivory bill. Wonderful backwoods names, King Woodchucker, not the Lord God bird. It's not on there. I think one of the reasons the name has become so attached to the bird is partly what I was trying to suggest before when I talked about the very title of the book, this desire to find in nature some sort of wholeness after Darwin, after the fragmentation of the industrial age. What can we find in the natural world that brings us a sense of harmony and wholeness? And so it has become the Lord God bird, whether it was before. I'm just going to read two paragraphs. As a rule, I tend to avoid activities that require snake-proof boots. But when I learned about a possible sighting of an ivory-billed woodpecker, I knew at once that I would be going down to the Louisiana swamp where the bird was reportedly seen in the Pearl River Wildlife Management Area. This was in the fall of 2000, before September 11 darkened and diverted my vision, before Hurricane Katrina virtually destroyed the Pearl River Refuge, before a purported 2004 sighting of the woodpecker in Arkansas became national news, before my second child was born, in short, a lifetime ago. I had been birdwatching only about 5 years at that point, and though I was quite devoted, I wasn't then and am not now a diehard lister, the sort of person who rushes off binoculars in hand whenever a rare bird is spotted. The British call such people twitchers, as if birdwatching were a disease of the central nervous system. I was and am a simple birdwatcher, a much more comprehensive and, to me, appealing term that makes room for King Solomon, Roger Torrey Peterson, and millions of people with backyards and bird feeders. But though I am no twitcher, news of an ivory-billed woodpecker did make me jump, and that is because the ivory-billed woodpecker wasn't a rare bird. It was extinct. So I'm going to leave myself in the swamp there, but know that that bird matters and is woven through. And I'm going to read a little bit and talk a little bit about another section. One of the things that I care about very much and that bird watching opened an unexpected door to is American history itself. And one of the wonderful things about American history is that it's still not that long. So you really can, in a handful of lifetimes, span a remarkable expanse of it. And Audubon, John James Audubon's very important to this book. He was, if not the father of American ornithology, he's certainly the greatest bird artist in America and the father of bird art. Alexander Wilson is kind of the father of American ornithology, but he's kind of the godfather of American ornithology. Anyway, Audubon arrived in this country in 1803 when Thomas Jefferson was president, the year of the Louisiana Purchase when the country suddenly doubled in size. But by the 1840s, he had already built himself a house in Manhattan on the Hudson River, and his good friend Samuel Morse sent and received the first telegraphic message to Philadelphia. Immediately, in the blink of an eye, shrinking this enormous continent more than anyone had ever imagined. And then 100 years after Audubon arrived, he arrives in 1803, Jefferson's president. In 1903, 100 years later, Teddy Roosevelt's president, the president who presided over our entry into the 20th century, the century when we really developed the ability, not metaphorically but literally, to destroy the entire natural world and ourselves along with it. A century in which, if Roosevelt had not begun to sign into law the preservation of wild places, they simply would no longer be here. The frontier was not only closed, but the country had begun to double back on itself and really consume itself. And yet, different as the world that Roosevelt lived in and Audubon lived in, they are kind of strangely connected. Roosevelt learned taxidermy from a man who'd sailed up the Missouri River with Audubon. And so what's remarkable is that these two lives actually overlap in a certain way, and yet by the time you get to Roosevelt, you get to a world of irrevocable change, a world that we're still living inside of. And Roosevelt was a great bird watcher. In addition to being a great hunter, he was perhaps the last person to see passenger pigeons in the wild fly overhead, although nobody believed him, including his friend John Burroughs, who was a great naturalist. He had very bad vision, obviously, Roosevelt. He always had those glasses, but he was a really great bird watcher. So I'm just going to read a little bit about Audubon, mainly to get to a story that Audubon tells in his autobiography that I find very haunting and emblematic. Stand in front of the Grand Central Park West entrance of the American Museum of Natural History in Manhattan, so instrumental in the rise of modern bird watching, and look up. All the way up, past the great bronze statue of Theodore Roosevelt, mounted on his horse, attended by a proud but subjugated Indian. Past the pigeon sitting on Roosevelt's head, past the president and the pigeon and the long flight of stone steps and the great banners announcing the Butterfly Conservatory or the exhibit devoted to chocolate, attempting to disguise the fact that the museum is primarily a giant mausoleum. And they use beetles to eat the flesh off their specimens, which I'll talk about another time, perhaps. Keep looking up. Perched at the top of the building's facade, you will see four figures made of stone: Meriwether Lewis, William Clark, Daniel Boone, and John James Audubon. They are like the four evangelists on the facade of a cathedral. These men, all born in the 18th century, hover over the modern era of bird watching the way they preside over Roosevelt's statue. Roosevelt, whom I will write about later, though I won't talk about him anymore, I think, here, was to some degree play-acting a drama that these men lived. They hail from the time when categories were more fluid, when exploration, soldiering, science, and sport were often hard to tell apart. Even Audubon, the only artist in this group of adventurers, and the man whose name is synonymous today with bird watching and bird conservation, is leaning on a gun. So I'm going to skip to this little portion just to tell this little story that Audubon tells. Audubon's awakening to the avian world, much like modern bird watching itself, grows out of murder, loss, and longing. On the first page of Myself, his memoir addressed to his children, Audubon writes that when he was a little boy, a monkey killed his favorite parrot. Audubon tells his children that he has thought of this violent episode thousands of times, remembers it as if it happened this very day, and that it's possible the event led him to love birds and study them with infinite pleasure. The story is a parable about people and birds as much as it is a true life narrative. It's a weird story, and yet emblematic in so many ways, it's worth looking at in detail. In fact, he actually invented elements of it, and I write in other places about how and why, but its emblematic truth is sufficient to bear looking at here. My mother, Audubon writes, had several beautiful parrots and some monkeys. One of the latter was a full-grown male of a very large species. One morning, the servants were arranging little Audubon's room when Pretty Polly, as he calls the parrot, asked for her breakfast as usual. Du pain au lait pour le perroquet mignon. The parrot spoke French, as did Audubon, as he was living in what was to become Haiti after the slave revolt. For some reason, the monkey, whom Audubon refers to as the man of the woods, seemed, quote, to grow offended at the bird presuming upon his rights in the scale of nature. Whatever the cause, the monkey certainly showed his supremacy in strength over the denizen of the air for walking deliberately and uprightly toward the poor bird. He had once killed it with unnatural composure. That's the way it is with birds. They represent life, but they're always dying. In other words, Audubon's mother had a monkey and some parrots, and one morning the parrot asked for breakfast, and the monkey got up and killed it. One of the things I find so fascinating about this story is that Audubon, this identification is all with the talking bird, with the parrot, and this delicate creature who gets murdered. But Audubon was himself a tremendous killer of birds. I mean, his diary was actually wonderful, and he writes in this kind of flowery and wonderful way, is often just a catalog of the birds he killed. But then he posed them in very lifelike ways. That was his great innovation. He created this board with nails on it so he could impale the birds in lifelike postures and basically bring them back to life. He killed them in order to capture them, if you will. And he really knew that he was not just the talking bird. He was also the killer primate. He was the man of the woods. And I think it's wonderful that this story has these two animals with really the two signal aspects of human distinctiveness. You know, our ability to speak, and our upright carriage. And for me, a tremendous amount of, I don't know, I wouldn't say a tremendous amount of bird watching. I would say bird watching makes me aware of how much that is our struggle in our relationship to the natural world. Just keeping those two elements, which both live inside of us, the talking bird and the killer primate, in balance. And as I say, Audubon, who was a bit of a fabulator, fabulated this story for other reasons, complex reasons, actually racial reasons in interesting ways, but I won't speak about it now because it sounds that note that is so important to me about those twin impulses that we evolved to go at nature with all we had, even though we now live in a world in which we must prop up the very thing that we are almost programmed to tear down, and that, if nothing else, makes for a very complicated mixture of elements. And now I'm just going to read a little bit from the epilogue. I'm skipping over this whole section where I do write about Alfred Russel Wallace, who's a great hero of mine, co-discoverer of the theory of evolution, but also somebody who, after he discovered the theory of evolution, spent 4 more years in Indonesia looking for the bird of paradise, this beautiful, rare, exotic bird. And when he found it, he actually said it was his greatest discovery, even though he'd already discovered the theory of evolution by means of natural selection. And I'm very moved by that as well. It's almost as if he wanted to find a bird whose very name, the bird of paradise, conjured up the Eden that his own scientific theory had somehow shattered, and hold both those things in his mind, in his hand. But this is the epilogue, and the epigraph to the epilogue is as follows. What was the name of my best friend? And that's Emerson, suffering from dementia, asking about Thoreau. Emerson and Thoreau both play a role in the book. Thoreau in particular is quite important to me. I found that line in a wonderful biography of Emerson called The Mind on Fire. Here's Emerson, this man who not only had his mind was literally on fire, he also knew the name of every plant on his property, who at the end of his life couldn't remember Thoreau's name. Birdwatching for me has a tremendous amount to do with memory. Quite literally, you need to remember what the birds look like. You need to remember what they sound like. You need to remember what have their different plumages look like. I have quite a poor memory. Every spring, I'm a kind of blank slate in a way. I start again, you know, but that only makes it more interesting. And you make lists when you're a birder because the birds themselves are fleeting. They're fleeting because they're migrating. They're fleeting because they don't stay still. They're fleeting because many of them are on the brink. One out of every 4 species, according to Audubon Society, is in some sense threatened. And you keep these lists almost as if you're interposing them between you and forgetting, and against some larger sense of forgetting. I mean, I often feel that birds, you really look at them the way you look at stars against the black drop of the sky, against a sense of their impending extinction, if not the large extinction of their species, than just the fact that they're going to disappear. When I went down to look for the ivory bill the first time, and I've gone several other times, in 2000, my father had recently been diagnosed with dementia, was really losing his memory. I used to go visit him. He was in a nursing home in Manhattan on 106th Street near Central Park, actually, and I would always bring my binoculars when I would go. And I would visit him, and afterwards I would go to the park. 106 is the old natural border of Central Park. It was extended to 110th Street later, but the original plan ended at 106. It almost feels a little wilder up there. And I would run into the park, and I was early enough in my birding. Every bird name seemed like it was a new thing to be remembered. You know, black-throated blue, prairie warbler, brown thrasher, all these great names. I would write them down, not even to keep the list, just to write them down. And I felt almost as if I were shoring up a sort of memory against a sense of what it means to lose your memory. And even the search for the ivory-billed woodpecker took on an added overtone, really, of that desire to find something and hold on to something, as if extinction itself is a kind of memory. Loss. It's a kind of cosmic memory loss, as if something could disappear not just from a single mind, but, you know, from the mind of God, from the mind of the world. And it added a sense of desperation, I think, to that search and to the understanding of what it means to search for things and to try to recover them. At the end of his life, Audubon developed dementia, possibly because of the arsenic that they used to use to preserve specimens, which eroded the mind. But I think a lot about Audubon at the end of his life. All those bird names that he knew, many of which he had invented himself, just flew out of his head. And again, I try to sort of match that image or pit against it the sense of young Audubon arriving in this country in 1803 when the world was new to him. America itself had just doubled in size. It was full of birds he'd never seen before, never named before, and to try to hold those things in balance. And as I say, birds for me very much are these mediating elements between earth and sky, between us and the wild world, between memory even and forgetting. And really, at bottom, the essence of bird watching for me is just the desire for more life. That's really all it is, desire to see more life, to hold on to it, to preserve it. So I'm just going to read a little bit from the epilogue, and then if you have any questions, I'll be very happy to try to answer them. My favorite place to watch birds in Central Park is Tanner Spring, a humble little area not even located in the park's wooded interior, but just off Central Park West, 100 yards north of the Diana Ross Playground. The spring at the base of a slanting mica-flecked rock is perhaps 10 feet long and 3 feet across, but it is a peaceful spot, hidden by trees and bushes. I find myself linking Tanner Spring with James T. Tanner, the man who studied the ivory-billed woodpecker in the 1930s. The name has nothing to do with him, of course. But still, I find in my private association something more than the merely idiosyncratic. There is a bench at Tanner Spring made from a slab of stone, and on a good day, you can see an oven bird, grackles, perhaps a Swainson's thrush, a magnolia warbler, a towhee taking a bath. I've seen a Blackburnian warbler, orange throat blazing, come down to drink. Flickers seem to like it. Some days, of course, there's nothing but starlings. Tanner's Spring has its human history as well as its natural history. This is where the residents of Seneca Village, the 19th-century community of African Americans, drew their water before they were displaced to make room for Central Park in the 1850s. They were not a powerful community. They could not fight off eviction, and nobody knows where they went. Some days, it is harder than others to see the world in a grain of sand. Tanner's Spring looks like what it is, a puddle-sized splash of water clogged with leaves, protected unaesthetically by a wire storm fence and haunted by human history. But most days, bird watching continues to work its magic. My curiosity gets the better of me, and I can't stop looking. The birds that come to drink are real and wild. My daughters, whom I sometimes bring to the spot, are as real as the birds. And when I explain to my elder that once this was a spring that watered a village and that a girl perhaps her own age came to the pump that must once have stood there to get water for her family, she understands, as only a 7-year-old can, that her imagination of an alternate world isn't a betrayal of reality, but a way of doing it greater justice. Birding is a world of small gestures, but small gestures can change the world. It sometimes occurs to me that the trees planted in Central Park, even the ones near Tanner Spring, are in some cases more than 150 years old. They are old enough to support ivory-billed woodpeckers, in fact, if only the birds lived in this region. Many days in New York City, if I haven't had time for proper bird watching, I go to Tanner Spring to sit on the stone bench for the last hour of light. This is a good time to see birds come for a final bath or a stealthy drink before vanishing into the branches. Magic hour is what the searchers I met in the White River Wildlife Refuge in Arkansas called the last hour of daylight, when each of them went out into the woods alone and sat down as quietly as possible near a possible roost hole in the hope that at dusk an ivory bill would appear. I know that what they did and what I do are very different, but they are also connected. Tanner's Spring is the merest echo of the big woods of Arkansas, but the big woods of Arkansas are themselves the merest echo of what they used to be, and still they are all connected. Just as backyard birds are in fact birds of paradise. It just depends on your definition of backyard and paradise. Recently, my friends Andy and Rob emailed me that a group of scientists from Auburn University in Alabama have seen an ivory bill in Florida near the Choctawhatchee River, a remote area of the Florida Panhandle. Perhaps we will go looking there. But even if we don't, other people will. Awareness of the wild world will grow, and the Nature Conservancy will buy up land in the area, not the most picturesque land, but the land likeliest to sustain the bird, and if it can sustain that bird, it can sustain a lot of others. We cannot change the world until we change our consciousness of it. What sort of species are we, and might we still become? The answer is still being written, even at this late date. This is the magic hour. There is still time before the light fades, and there is no longer anything left to see. Thank you. Yes.
Excuse me, I just want to say that was one of the most beautiful talks I've ever heard.
Oh, thank you.
It was really extraordinary.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And I want to know what your take is at the moment on the ivory billed.
You know, I truly don't know what all the people I've spoken to who claim to have seen the bird are completely believable people. And I don't feel that any of them has fabricated the sighting. Unfortunately, there isn't the ocular proof. Othello yells, bring me the ocular proof. There has to be a photograph. There is this bit of video, and it's been parsed more than the Zapruder film, and it is... I'm persuaded by it, but I also know the guy who took the video. He took it completely by accident, by his own admission. It just happened to be on his boat running continuously. But, you know, I do keep finding myself saying, I don't know if it's Carl Sagan who said it, but I think so, absence of evidence isn't evidence of absence. On the other hand, that may work for God, but eventually, for a bird, you will eventually need a photograph, and I think we'll know. Instinctively, I believe it exists. Whether that means it could even be saved, whether it could be captured and or preserved enough to breed, whether it could sustain itself in any meaningful way. That's the real question. What's sad is there was so much elation and excitement in 2004 when it looked like the bird had been found, as if the answer to its problems and all that went with it had been discovered. But in fact, it was really just supposed to be the beginning of it. But I'm hopeful, and the people I know who are searching, and many of them are very serious people. I mean, there are people on both sides, and they're all really serious. You know, the Cornell Lab of Ornithology has thrown its weight behind the veracity of that sighting and that film. But then there are other people equally eminent who say no. And so I don't know the answer, of course, but it continues to live in this strange liminal place.
It's uncommon, I think, to write as beautifully as you do both nonfiction and fiction, and I wondered if you could talk just for a minute about how you navigate between the two and, you know, how you make choices about what you want to do next and what world you want to work in.
Well, first of all, thank you. That's a very, very nice thing to say. I have no idea. When I started out writing, I just thought being a writer meant being a fiction writer. That's what it meant, to invent your own world. And then it seemed like the world pressing down on you was at war with the fictional world that you wanted to create. And then at some point, you make your peace with the world and you realize that that's not true. And there are different forms for the different things you want to do and say. And I'd like everything I write to feel that it has that shape, you know, an autonomous shape, so that its metaphorical life is real and so is its literal embodiment and truthfulness. But truthfully, you feel that when you're writing fiction too. You know, you don't want your character to be a hollow allegory, but you do want your character to reverberate with some meaning as well. And yet you also want it to be believable and whole and flesh and blood. And so I don't have a good way of answering it, except that I think of everything now as just being writing in a certain way. Not necessarily. Cynthia Ozick, a wonderful writer who is a family friend, gave me a pen once, and she said, whether you use this for the sacred purpose, quoting Henry James, or merely for writing, with lowercase w, and she meant by the sacred purpose fiction writing. But I now think either everything should be uppercase or everything should be lowercase. But
my fascination with birds, which isn't very disciplined or scientific, but it began while I was hunting, and I was with my father, and we were on land that belonged to a friend of his, and my father thought he was doing this friend a favor by shooting a crow out of the sky, which he presumed was, you know, marauding the fields or whatever. And that was the first time I ever got up close to at that time, what I considered a great beast. And I was astonished by the expressiveness of this animal as it died, the defiance and the fear, and also the many colors that I saw reflected in what at a distance seemed just plain black feathers. And ever since then, I've watched birds. And right now, I love my backyard with its feeder and its basin of water and everything that it attracts, including a predator, which in its own way feeds at the feeder. My question to you is, what could urban America do to make a little bit more room for the life of birds?
Yeah, it is a beautiful story. It's also a great story, not necessarily inadvertently, but the experience you had watching a bird die does say something about the incredible intimacy that those early hunters of birds had with those animals, that they encountered them in their dying and somehow really got to know them. I mean, I was once at a friend's house and a black-capped chickadee flew into the glass and died, and I picked it up and I thought, now I know why they shot them, because you see every feather, and lots of the names that birds have, you know, refer to some tiny detail that you can only see when you're holding the bird. What we can do to stop sprawl is... it's funny, I gave a talk at Fish and Wildlife yesterday, and the historian at Fish and Wildlife, who's a wonderful guy, drove me here to D.C. today, and he was saying that's the one thing that no one knows what to do about. You know, you can't preserve the area between suburbs and call it a wildlife refuge. And so how you create those areas is extremely difficult, obviously. You have to sort of stick to the system we've got, which is the system of large refuges, and keep them going. But there's an additional problem, which is that if the environment changes, as it seems to be, then these refuges will no longer be the proper habitat for certain species. And then we really have an additional problem. Me, I feel like a humble thing that bird watchers can and ought to do is to do something that hunters do, which is hunters have to buy a license whenever they go hunting. There are many fewer hunters than there are bird watchers, actually. But bird watchers don't have any clout in Washington, because all you do is you just get your binoculars and you go outside. It's the ultimate independent thing to do. And, you know, every now and then someone floats the idea of a tax on bird seed, because most of those 47.8 million bird watchers that Fish and Wildlife talks about are backyard birders. But hunters all buy a duck stamp, or you go fishing, you buy a fishing license. And it's not very expensive, but it adds up. And 47.8 million is a big number, and it would at least take a very large group of people who spend a ton of money doing other things with their birding activity, and perhaps create more lobbying pressure to do exactly what with, I don't know. But I think it would be a thing to do. But I don't really know the answer. I just do. I think the only other thing I'd say, one of the reasons that I also love bird watching, is because you really do have to love something in order to save it. You can't simply tell somebody that something is endangered. That's why they always try to pick charismatic species, you know, because it's a species that everyone can love. But when I started bird watching, I really just fell in love with the fact that there were all these birds. And then when I went bird watching in Central Park, I thought birds were everywhere because I'd never seen so many during migration. And then, of course, I found out that one of the reasons there are so many birds in Central Park is because they have no place else to land, because when they fly overhead, it's the only green patch in sight. And so it was really a kind of artificial profusion. But by then, I was already hooked, you know, and it's like what the Tin Man says, now I know I have a heart because it's breaking. You know, I finally woke up to the natural world, and I was being robbed of it, and then I really cared. And Roger Torrey Peterson said, make a birder, make an environmentalist. So I think, you know, because birds are everywhere, at least people can, in a sense, fall in love with the natural world, which, of course, is not falling in love with the world outside of ourselves. It's falling in love with an aspect of ourselves that we may or may not acknowledge.
Thanks for joining us on Book Tour. For more readings and discussions like this one, please visit npr.org/booktour.